I'm Sam Hirschman.
And I'm Alan Zhao. This week on War News Radio, Best of Spring 2011, we're replaying some of our best pieces of this semester.
First, we'll hear about the Base Track program and the controversy surrounding its sudden closure.
Then, we'll learn about training the Afghan National Army.
Finally, we talked to a Swarthmore alumnus who returned home to Afghanistan following graduation.
Whether or not you have a loved one in the military, it's difficult to imagine the daily reality for soldiers currently serving in America's longest war. Base Track, an experimental media group, has been on the ground with one U.S. Marine Corps battalion at a base in southern Afghanistan, but was suddenly shut down by the USMC in February. Eliana Bisgard Church has more in this piece, first aired last month.
If you go to Base Track's Facebook page, you can meet Americans with an active investment in the war in Afghanistan. Posts from people debating the causes of the Afghan insurgency, or the WikiLeaks phenomenon, are sandwiched between posts from mothers and fathers wondering how their sons are doing. Jeff Johnson, whose son is a supply officer currently in Afghanistan, is an avid follower of BaseTrack.org and comments on its Facebook page daily.
I read many of the things that the wives and the mothers and the other family members put out there, and it gives you a perspective of, you know, my son's not really in combat, but those people, their children or their spouses are, you know, out in the field dodging bullets, and it's all out there. You can feel their anxiety. I think in that way it connects me with them.
The Facebook comments have recently centered on one topic, though. That Base Track, an experimental media project following the 1st Battalion, 8th Marines, or 1-8, received a letter from a public affairs officer informing them that they are, quote, being asked to leave 1-8's positions due to perceived operational security violations on portions of their website, end quote. The journalists are not formally disembedded, which would require proven security violations. But the letter specifically noted Base Track's use of Google Maps on their website. Base Track's founder, Chiru Kueyama, says that they have specifically altered the map points to be non-targetable. Uncertain about the letter's language and reasoning, Kueyama has attempted to contact public affairs, but has been unsuccessful.
The letter from the public affairs officers was certainly a surprise, saying that there's operational security violations with the BaseTrack.org website, and that the Marine Battalion didn't have the manpower or the logistical capability to accommodate us for the next few weeks. So I basically had different camps saying totally different things. It was very unclear who any of it was coming from, and my immediate response when I get this letter seemed as an OPSEC violation is to write back and say, hey, if there's an OPSEC violation, you know, let's work together and deal with it so that nobody's life is endangered, but no response at all to that. So it was really confusing.
Kueyama believes that there are other motives in place.
The most recent correspondence that I've gotten from the head of public affairs of the Marine Corps in Afghanistan is that there's no OPSEC violation. They've, you know, repeatedly said that the project has been overwhelmingly popular, and that everybody that we've worked with in the military seems to like us a lot. So my gut feeling is that someone in the Pentagon saw the Base Track site and really wigged out. And it's not hard for me to believe that somebody, especially maybe, you know, an older Marine, a very senior one, thought that there was an OPSEC violation, or looks at a computer screen and sees some technology that they don't really get, but they'd much rather have it just go away.
Base Track certainly has made an impact online. Through art, personal reflections, photos, and other media, Base Track has strived to connect Americans with loved ones in the service. Base Track's Matt Farwell wanted to bring the stories home.
The goal was to connect the families. That was one of the goals. The goal was to bring some sort of emotional connection to Americans who, you know, just kind of see the war on TV and then wonder, okay, yeah, Afghanistan war and American Idol, let's see. Okay, American Idol, right? And that's about the same level of engagement they have with it to give them some sort of gut investment in it next time they go into a ballot box or go call their congressman or do whatever they do. And we're not trying to tell them how to think or what to think. We're just trying to tell them to think.
Bass Track is an extremely diverse group, with members from New York to San Francisco to Hungary to Pakistan. Jeff Johnson likes the mix.
The diversity of the group of people that are involved in the media, for instance, the retired Army gentleman, Matt Farwell, you know, he gives you a perspective from the military side. The rest of them have other media backgrounds, which gives them very diverse perspectives.
Johnson says the mix of media matters as well.
To me, it's the diversity of the different media types that make the site. You know, you can see pictures, but you can also see videos, and it's very interesting to hear these young Marines that are putting themselves in harm's way, and to see and hear them. The other things that I'm really interested in are the links in the articles that the Bass Track people connect you with to read about all aspects of the war.
Farwell is the only member with military experience. He was a U.S. Army soldier from 2005 to 2010 and served 16 months in Afghanistan during 2006 and 2007, which he says was one of the heaviest points in the conflict. He has been writing of the effects of war on returning soldiers based on personal experience.
War is a terrible thing. You go and you kill people, and people try and kill you. And that's if you're actually a frontline on-the-ground soldier. And then there are people that are outside every day, sleeping in mud, living a pretty brutal, nasty life. Since being back, I've had a rough time. But, you know, it's something that people need to be aware of before they really glorify and, you know, seek to label everyone a hero. That's part of what I'm trying to do, is say that, you know, the responsibility of the American citizen doesn't end with the clap and the yellow ribbon.
In addition to informing their audiences, Bass Track members have also helped Marines more directly at times.
Obviously, we can't accommodate everybody as much as we'd like to, but if it's possible and if we can, you know, we'll say, hey, Private so-and-so, your mom says hi, or to one of the moms, that your son looks good, you know, he's dirty, and but that's the way he likes it, or, you know, something like that. So a bit more of a connection that way, and a bit more of an intimate connection that way.
Farwell says resources available through Bass Track's different pages have excited its followers.
I mean, I've been blown away by the nuanced level of discussion, intelligent comments, and, you know, back and forth of these people that have not only great emotional investment in what's going on over there, but often, you know, a completely, like, different perspective. You know, you have mothers and grandmothers and wives and sisters and brothers and veterans and, you know, everything. You really get good perspective that I don't think you find anywhere else.
Responses to Bass Track have been supportive and enthusiastic.
Personal responses, I've gotten quite a few, and I've developed, you know, quite a few online friendships with some of the family members and followers that just want to know a little bit more about what's going on and kind of what their sons or their family members or whoever's over there might be going through. And so I kind of share my experience, and especially my experience after coming back.
Connecting with family members speaks to the strength of the project, which has created a phenomenon Kuwayama believes will allow Bass Track to continue.
One of the core concepts of the project, I think, bore out
which was that we weren't just embedding with the Marines themselves in Afghanistan. We were embedding with their families in a virtual space. In our case, we have a timed audience, but they're actually all, they're the families of the Marines that we're embedded with. And I mean, ultimately when this whole thing was going down and people were telling us that we were being ejected, you know, my response is always, you know, you do whatever you have to do. You don't have to explain anything to me. You have to explain it to the wives and mothers and the families of 1,000 Marines. If you can do that, you're home free.
Johnson has enjoyed being able to see more of what the Marines are doing, but he was not very surprised at the news of the cancellation.
No, I was a little bit surprised until I sat back and considered everything, and I thought, well, this event isn't all that surprising. Some of the families are devastated because it's going off the air, but I don't think it's the end of the concept.
It's done a lot of good. These other family members that are on here are just so grateful to BaseTrack. I hear them, or I see their comments. They're so grateful to BaseTrack to be in touch with their family.
The BaseTrack team will not give up easily. Next, they plan to distribute the remaining 1-8 content and plan new projects.
Once we get through this, like, yeah, we're back full steam to doing the thing that we set out here to do, which is actually to share photos and reports reporting with these Marine families. It doesn't look like we're going to be invited back into our previously scheduled embed, but you know, fundamentally, that's not remotely the end of the project, because in a lot of ways, the center of gravity with the project isn't actually in Afghanistan. It's in Facebook, or it's in Twitter, or it's virtual. It's the families of these Marines, not the Marines themselves. So that all continues. And right now, I've got something like half a dozen people floating around Afghanistan, Pakistan, and the United Arab Emirates, waiting to see where to go next. And there's definitely a lot of stuff happening out there. So I think that's where the project goes. We're still on the ground in Afghanistan, and I think wherever we go in Afghanistan, we're taking the families of 1,000 Marines with us.
War News Radio attempted to call the Marine Corps public affairs officer who signed the letter, which BaseTrack has published, but the phone number he provided seemed to be out of order. Though BaseTrack has not yet announced any new specifics, they have already made an impact and expect to continue to do so. You can follow them on Facebook or at basetrack.org. For War News Radio, I'm Eliana Biscard Church.
After the 2001 invasion of Afghanistan, the Taliban military forces were dissolved, leaving security in the hands of NATO. 9 years later, war-fatigued electorates in America and elsewhere have been clamoring for the withdrawal of troops and resources from Afghanistan. Amandine Lee brings us more on the U.S. military's attempts to transition the security burden to the fledgling Afghan National Army. This piece first aired in February.
In March 2009, when President Obama presented his strategy for Afghanistan and Pakistan, he confirmed the surge of 17,000 additional American troops to the region. Just as importantly, he put forth his plans for Afghanistan's own military forces.
We will shift the emphasis of our mission to training and increasing the size of Afghan security forces so that they can eventually take the lead in securing their country. That's how we will prepare Afghans to take responsibility for their security and how we will ultimately be able to bring our own troops home.
The U.S. faces twin issues in Afghanistan, securing the land against insurgents and moving the country towards self-sufficiency so that American forces can leave. Obama's strategy strives to reconcile these issues by relying more on Afghanistan's military. But this entails a variety of new headaches. In 2009, Obama promised 4,000 troops dedicated to training Afghan soldiers. Lieutenant Colonel George Gatling of the U.S. Army is one man on the job, operating just outside of Kabul.
I am the OIC of an 18-man training mentor team. We came over, and our mission was to train and mentor an Afghan battalion, which is approximately 700, 800 soldiers.
Alongside classes on how to identify IEDs, set up a checkpoint, and read maps, Afghan soldiers must also learn how to function as a group. Gatling says one of the biggest tasks for his program is to get Afghan officers to show concern for their subordinates.
The officers will not be where the enlisted soldiers are receiving the training. They will be somewhere else, and we've taught them that if you are the platoon leader or if you are the company commander, your place of duty, you should be where your soldiers are. So you can start to learn who your soldiers are, how they act, how they operate, and the soldiers will get familiar with you.
Stephen Biddle, Roger Hertog's senior fellow for defense policy at the Council on Foreign Relations, says that this is part of a program that the U.S. undertakes every time they try to build up a foreign military organization, instilling Western military values.
In Western military culture, and for the United States in particular, there's a very strong ethic that says that the soldier's interest should be put before and above the officer's interest. So, for example, at mealtime on an American military post, the enlisted, or out in the field, more importantly, the enlisted eat first, the officers eat second. There are many parts of the Afghan army where officers believe that they are by right due privileges that the enlisted are not, and are prepared to exploit enlisted soldiers for their own benefit by redirecting pay, for example.
Exploitative officers are just one dysfunction U.S. troops deal with when training Afghan soldiers. There are also language barriers, ethnic tensions between groups, and, Gatling says, incredibly low literacy rates among the recruits.
The vast majority of the soldiers that are coming in right now cannot, unfortunately, read or write, but the Afghan National Army has a literacy program.
In addition, drug use is prevalent everywhere in Afghanistan. Time magazine reports that a quarter of all troops use hashish or opium, though Gatling says it hasn't been an issue so far.
I've been here for 5 months, and we have never had any issues or incidents with any of the soldiers because they were chewing that or using that. And it's not that prevalent.
So why exactly is the U.S. investing so much money and effort in training a military organization that is not their own? Well, a lot of effective troops need to be on the ground, policing the populace and rooting out insurgents, if there is any hope that the war with the Taliban will come to a close. And Biddle says it's in America's interest that as many of these soldiers as possible come from the Afghan public.
It's a lot cheaper to field one Afghan soldier than to field one U.S. Marine or one U.S. Army infantryman. It's more popular in the United States because it means fewer Americans at risk of getting killed. And it may prove to be more effective in as much as the Afghan forces you're building up speak the local language, they're part of the local culture, their ability to interact with the civilians they're operating among is probably better in many cases than ours.
Afghans have their own incentives to go to recruitment depots.
Good work is hard to find in Afghanistan, and the security forces are reliably paid, pretty reliably fed, pretty reliably housed. Those are important incentives to join up. I would not discount the role that the desire to defeat the Taliban plays in recruitment. The Taliban are a notably unpopular organization in Afghanistan. Afghans have been repeatedly polled, and in no poll of which I am aware has the Taliban ever rated above 15% acceptability in the population as a whole.
That being said, there is plenty of controversy over just how big the ANA should grow to be. At any given time, it's hard to pinpoint the exact number of soldiers, given the flux of recruits, desertions, and casualties. But Biddle puts it around 200,000 to 250,000. And the target number keeps rising.
There has been a proposal to increase the target for the size of the Afghan security forces, the police plus the army, to 400,000. That has not been agreed upon yet because it's proven controversial, in part because the Pakistanis are nervous about the idea of a 400,000-person security force on their western border that they don't control, and in part because there's skepticism in some significant parts of the West about whether a 400,000-person security force is sustainable financially.
Gatling says the one big problem is that those Afghan troops that do exist really can't operate alone like their American counterparts.
Even though they've graduated, they still need a lot of coaching and mentoring. And it usually takes maybe about a good 2 or 3 years for them to work and train and fight as a unit.
Biddle argues the complete self-sufficiency isn't a feasible goal anyway.
If that's what we insist on doing, if we're planning to hand off an ongoing war to a new military institution, I think the odds are very strong that we'll lose and that we'll hand off a defeat in the making. I think the right way to look at this is we are going to build up an indigenous Afghan partner together with that larger, more capable indigenous Afghan military. We are going to drive the war to a settlement that we can live with. And once the war is settled and the shooting has stopped, then we go home and the Afghan military significantly demobilizes back to a smaller size that they, with Western aid, can sustain for the long term.
Whatever the plan, it must be executed in time for complete withdrawal from Afghanistan in 2014. Well, maybe. Statements from the Pentagon and the Obama administration keep wavering over whether the deadline is set in stone or just a goal. For War News Radio, I'm Amandine Lee.
According to the Afghan Ministry of Higher Education, their university system still struggles with chronic shortages of funds, infrastructure, and teachers, and thus many Afghan students choose to pursue degrees abroad. From 2006 to 2010, Rahula Kalapawak attended Swarthmore College, an elite liberal arts institution near Philadelphia, and War News Radio's parent organization. Colin Smith recently interviewed him on his experiences. This piece first aired in February.
Could you just tell us who you are?
My name is Rahula. I'm from Afghanistan. I finished my high school studies here in Afghanistan, but had the opportunity to come to the United States in 2006. Swarthmore generously awarded me scholarship, full scholarship. Studied there for 4 years. I majored in Middle Eastern Studies and returned back to Afghanistan right after my graduation with Swarthmore.
Why did you come to the U.S.?
You know, American colleges are known throughout the world to have the best, you know, teaching and education system. My whole aim, you know, while at Swarthmore and studying at Swarthmore was to return back to Afghanistan and work in the government or in other institutions so I can contribute directly to the Afghan people.
How did you get the opportunity to study in the United States?
When I finished my high school in 2001, Afghanistan was invaded by the U.S. As soon as the Taliban left the country in 2001, I joined media organization or journalists who came to Afghanistan to cover the war. I started with Time magazine first, you know, working there with fixer, translator, and a guide. After that, I was hired by the New York Times. So I worked until 2006 before I leave for America with the New York Times. Basically, I was here in Afghanistan working for the New York Times, and I saw the opportunity that New York Times is also an American newspaper. It will be more possible to good American than any other country because most of the journalists are Americans. And so I tried, and they convinced me to apply to different colleges. So I applied to probably, I think, 5 or 6 colleges throughout the East Coast of the United States. Swarthmore was very generous, and they awarded me a full scholarship.
What was Swarthmore College like?
It was very tough, but also at the same time, a lot of fun. I had good friends and very good time in the 4 years I was there. Though in the beginning, it was very difficult for me. I had to adjust to, you know, the culture as well as adjust to the educational system. But Swarthmore was very helpful. A lot of my professors, they gave me a lot of their time to explain things and help me out to adjust to the system.
How are you perceived as an Afghan here in America?
Yeah, I was worried about this. I used to hear, you know, some people were saying in America you would be treated differently, and I used to hear a lot of this before I leave for America in 2006. But it was completely different, you know. Swarthmore, the people, the educated people, they were very, very nice and actually very interested to talk to me, which I was surprised, you know, what I was hearing before, but what I was seeing at the time when I was there. People were very, very nice and very friendly to me. I never, in the whole 4 years, I never had any problems or I felt like I was looked upon different there. But I was treated very well.
So how is an American education valued by Afghans?
Definitely. If you speak English, that's the most preferred, you know, person, you know, to be hired by anyone. The countries that are involved in Afghanistan, their main language is English. But if you have a degree from the United States, you would be able to get a good job pretty fast.
As an Afghan who has seen America, what are your thoughts on the American occupation of your country?
Well, I think, you know, Afghanistan is different than the Middle East. You know, a lot of Middle Eastern countries, they have their own resources to gain and stand on their own feet. Afghanistan would very much destroy infrastructure. And our economy is very, very low compared to a lot of others. And I think there is a need for America to remain here and help the Afghan people to stand on their own feet and stabilize their country. We know everything, you know, September 11th, it happened from here. And Americans in America have committed to bring stability and peace to this country. So we'll see.
Rahul currently lives in Kandahar, Afghanistan, and continues to work at the Afghan news desk of the New York Times. For War News Radio, with Alan Zhao, I'm Colin Smith.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archive shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our producer is Jim McMillan. I'm Sam Hirschman.
And I'm Alan Zhao. Until next time.